Welcome to Resilience Agenda Radio, the mental fitness podcast. My name is Hadley Fisher. Here at Resilience Agenda, we're bringing you the latest on how to develop, maintain, and improve your mental fitness. With me today, we have
Nir Eyal. Nir is a Wall Street Journal best-selling author of two books, Hooked and Indistractable, a consultant and sought-after speaker for some of Silicon Valley's largest companies. He's a prolific blogger, productivity and digital well-being thinker, former marketing professor at Stanford, and successful entrepreneur and investor. And today, Nir joins us from Singapore. Nir, how are you going?
I'm doing all right, thank you. It's great to be here today.
First of all, how are you going with this whole COVID-19 situation? And everyone's talking about working from home these days. I'm sure when you wrote your most recent book, you didn't imagine that planning your time and finding ways to structure your day would become so important. How are you going with it all?
Well, this is exactly why I wrote Indistractable, and I'm so glad I did, because I think it would be incredibly difficult to get through this crisis without this methodology that I've developed over the past several years. And I wrote Indistractable over the past 5 years. The book was released in September, and the world was a very different place back then. And I think the distractibility has been turned up to 11, right? Like it is, the world is, if we thought the world was distracting before the current COVID crisis, it's only more distracting now. And I think it's what we've seen. I can see not only in terms of my book sales have shot up, but also in terms of the conversation, is that it is incredibly hard to stay committed to what it is you said you were going to do with your time. And so people are way more distracted. And I think what's going on is it's basically two real reasons here. Number one, I talk about in the book how the source of distraction is not what most people think it is. Most people think distraction is about, the pings and dings and rings and all these things in our environment that can lead us to distraction. It's all the stuff that's outside of us. And I think the big takeaway from Indistractable, or at least one of them, is that distraction begins from within. That distraction is not a character flaw. It's not something wrong with you. It's simply that we don't have a system and habits in place to help us stay true to what it is we say we will do with our time. And so what's happened is that, when you look at distraction has a common source, which is always a desire to escape from an uncomfortable sensation, right? When we are bored, we check the news. When we're lonely, we check Facebook. When we're uncertain, we Google. It's all about a desire to escape emotional discomfort. And so whether it's too much news, too much booze, too much football, too much Facebook, all of these things, all these too much, are all about the desire to escape our feelings. And so we have to face that fact. And so what's happened over the past few months here since we were working from home now due to the COVID crisis is that the anxiety has been ratcheted up, right? We have more anxiety, more uncertainty, more stress. And so that leads to a greater desire to escape our present reality. And so how do people do that? They do that by distracting themselves with television, with the news, with a drink too much, with whatever, right? There's lots of ways to take your head out of present reality. And that's what distraction is really all about. So that's one big reason. The second reason is that I think people didn't previously appreciate how structure in our life is really a foundational element of physical and psychological well-being. That we think, when we're going to retire someday, we'll be free. We can do whatever we want all day, and that's a nice fantasy. But it turns out that people really struggle with a lack of constraints. That constraints is really a factor in helping us be our best. And so now that we are missing the drive to work, the getting up in the morning, getting the kids off to school, the meetings, the all the stuff that used to be tedious and annoying, what we're finding is that without something to replace that structure, our days kind of seem to melt into one another. In fact, I just read an article yesterday about how Google is seeing a tremendous spike in search traffic for the term, what day is it? That people are searching in record numbers for what day is it? They don't know what day it is even, because they don't have this structure that they used to have in their normal work life. And so that's really difficult from a distraction perspective.
One of the things that I really took out of the book was that you can't be distracted unless you're distracted from something. And you talk about this idea of traction, which is our projects, our values, and our goals. Can you talk us through the difference between traction and distraction?
Yeah, this is a really, really important distinction, because if you ask most people about, you know, what is distraction actually? What does it all mean? They'll typically tell you about the tool that they are using to distract themselves. Right? It's the phone, it's the email, it's the whatever, the Slack notifications. That's what they call the distraction. But that's not really accurate. In fact, the best way to understand what distraction is to understand what distraction is not. So if you ask most people what's the opposite of distraction, they'll tell you the opposite of distraction is focus, right? Not exactly. The opposite of distraction, if you look at the origin of the word, the opposite of distraction is not focus. The opposite of distraction is traction. That both words come from the same Latin root, trahare, which means to pull. And they both end in the same six letters, A-C-T-I-O-N, that spells action. So traction, by definition, is any action that pulls you towards what you intend to do, things that you do with forethought, things that lead you towards your values and help you become the kind of person you want to become. Now, the opposite of traction is distraction, any action that pulls you away from what you plan to do, anything that you are not doing with intent, anything that is contrary to your values and the person you want to become. Now, you'll notice it's not about the specific behavior. And I argue that virtually any action can be either traction or distraction, right? For example, how many times have you sat down at your desk in the morning? And this is what I used to do all the time before I became indistractable. I would sit down at my desk and I'd say, okay, I'm not going to procrastinate. I'm going to do what I came here to do. I'm going to work on that big report. I'm going to finish that project I've been delaying, whatever it might be. I'm not going to get distracted. Here I go. I'm going to get started right away, right now. But first, let me check some email. Right? Let me do that one quick thing on my to-do list that's easy, because that'll make me feel good, right? That'll make me get some momentum. And I justified this to myself by saying, well, that's productive, right? I got to do email at some time today, don't I? Well, what I didn't realize is that when I did that, and virtually everybody does this, is that we prioritize the urgent at the expense of the important. And even the things that feel like work stuff are distractions. And in fact, they are the most pernicious form of distraction, because we don't even realize we're getting distracted, right? If you're playing Candy Crush while you're supposed to be at work, well, that's pretty obviously a distraction. You know it. If anybody saw you playing it on your screen, they would know it's a distraction. But when you're checking email, oh, that's a productive task, right? That's work-related. No, false, incorrect. It is a distraction, because it's not what you plan to do. And so most people are running around reacting to stuff, reacting to emails, reacting to notifications, reacting to stuff all day long, and they have no time for reflection, and they have no time to actually do the things that they themselves said they would do, which is why they don't get ahead. And so just as anything can be a distraction, I argue anything can be traction as well. So, you know, there's this narrative in the media these days that, you know, certain type of technologies are hijacking your brain, and they're addicting everybody, and they're melting your brain to mush. And it's total unscientific rubbish. It is ironically published by the media to get you to click on the articles. I mean, it's incredible. They are doing exactly what they are complaining that Facebook and Instagram are doing. It's the same thing that every media company does. Every media company turns your eyeballs into cash by monetizing your attention. The New York Times does it. The Wall Street Journal does it. The Financial Times does it. CNN does it. Every media company is in the same exact business as Facebook. Now, there's nothing wrong with this. There's nothing wrong with reading the news or checking Facebook or watching a football match. It's all fine as long as you do it on your schedule, not the media companies. That's the big difference. We shouldn't vilify these technologies. I can't stand these productivity gurus that tell people, well, just stop checking email. Well, just stop using social media. Well, just disconnect. Go on a digital detox. Go on a 30-day digital fast. Come on, give me a break. You'll get fired from your job if you do that. It's elitist advice. And so instead of vilifying the technology and making these impossible goals for people, instead what we need to do is to figure out how to use these technologies in a way that serves us as opposed to us serving them. And that starts with understanding that none of this stuff is bad as long as you use it on your schedule, because the difference between traction and distraction is one word. And that one word is forethought. The time you plan to waste is not wasted time. So if you want to waste your time, quote unquote, watching a football game, watching the news, playing a video game, I don't care. As long as it's what you plan to do, it's traction. And you should do it without guilt.
What is the relationship between distraction, digital technologies, and mental health? How do they impact psychological and emotional health?
So I think a lot of it comes down to the idea of agency. I actually talk about this in the book. There's a section in the book about how to build an indistractable workplace. It's, I think, one of the more important findings in this book is research that I didn't do myself, but I think is not well known enough. This was work conducted at Oxford, I believe, by two researchers by the name of Stansfield and Candy. And these two researchers found that there's a certain type of work environment that has been shown not just to be correlated, which is what most studies find, it's just a correlative relationship, but as we all know, correlation is not causation. This study actually found a causal relationship with a type of workplace and the likelihood of depression and anxiety disorder, very rare in the social sciences. And if you would ask me before I read this study, what type of work do you think would lead to depression and anxiety disorder? My guess would have been, well, you know, very, very sad work, being a mortician, being maybe a veterinarian whose job it is to put down animals, or somebody, a social worker with people with a very difficult situation. None of that's true. It has nothing to do with the type of job you do, but rather the environment you do it in. That there is the confluence of two factors that have been shown to lead to depression, anxiety disorder. And those two factors in the workplace are when we work in a condition of high expectations coupled with low control. Okay, high expectations with low control. Now, it's interesting that the study found that if you have high expectations with high control, no problem. That actually people can flourish in those type of work environments. It's in the type of work environments where we have high expectations and low control, that's where people develop these pathologies, such as depression, anxiety disorder. And so I think we can relate this in many ways to various aspects of our life today. I mean, I think that kind of defines and sums up life these days. High expectations, right? We have to keep our jobs. Not only that, now we have to homeschool our children. Oh, and we have to make sure that we're as hygienic as someone working in a surgical ward. There's so many expectations placed upon us that it's very difficult to also lack the agency and control that we used to have. And that's very, very difficult. And I think if you add social media to the mix and people don't have the agency and control to moderate the flood of messages and pings and dings and rings, they can feel as if they are out of control. And so it's no surprise that that takes a toll on our mental health. Now, here's the thing. We have falsely believed a narrative that we don't have control. And in fact, in some ways, it's a vicious cycle, because the escape from anxiety is often the distraction that causes more anxiety. And so what we have to do is essentially take a step back, ask ourselves this critical question, which is this serving me or am I serving it? And that's with all forms of media. You know, we pick on social media, but I think you can say the exact same thing for the hysterics that we see on the television or in the radio or in the newspaper. That we have to ask ourselves with every source of media, is it serving me or am I serving it? And then to take a step back and to figure out, okay, it's not that this stuff is evil. It's that I need to control it as opposed to it controlling me. And the key word there being control, being agency. There's a lot of things you can't control in your life. Social media and technology is not one of them. You can absolutely control it, right? And it turns out that the vast majority of people do nothing about it but complain.
You talk about how the distractions that come from, say, social media are attempts to deal with discomfort. And then you explain internal triggers and contrast them from external triggers such as notifications. And you make the point that we just simply aren't very good at being alone. Trigger that I have is when I'm sitting here working or writing. I've just been recently writing the new draft of our 2021 planner, and I'll be deep in thought and I'll have a challenge or a problem, and I'll sort of come out of my flow and I'll find myself standing next to the kettle. So not social media, not watching Netflix for me, it's going to the kettle and making a cup of tea. So I guess that emotion is the discomfort of not knowing what to write, or just a bit of tiredness. I don't know. Can you explain for us how painful or negative emotions result in certain behaviors and choices?
Yeah, so I think this is where we really need to take a step back and understand, if we are to understand distraction, we have to start with a more fundamental question, which is not just why do we get distracted, but why do we do anything and everything? What is the nature of human motivation? And there's a lot of misunderstanding out there, I think, in the popular media and then the popular understanding of what motivates people. Most people subscribe to the idea that we do what we do in the pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain, right? This is the good old carrots and sticks. This is Jeremy Bentham said this, Sigmund Freud said this. And it turns out that it's not true, that what we do is not motivated by the desire to pursue pleasure and avoid pain, but from a neurological basis, it is only one thing. Everything we do, all human behavior, is spurred by a desire to escape discomfort. This is called the homeostatic response. So if you go outside and it's cold, your brain tells you, ooh, this doesn't feel good, you should put on a coat. And if you walk back inside and it's too hot, the brain says, oh, this is too hot, that doesn't feel good, take the coat off. If you feel hunger pangs, you eat. And if you eat too much, the brain says, oh, I feel stuffed, stop eating. So physiologically, this is common sense, of course. Everything is driven by the desire to escape discomfort. Even, by the way, the pursuit of pleasure, right? Even the pursuit of pleasure is itself psychologically destabilizing. Wanting, craving, desire, lusting. Wanting doesn't feel good. It spurs us. It's the discomfort that spurs us into action. There's a reason we say love hurts, because psychologically that is exactly what is happening in our brains. So what this means, therefore, physiologically, this is pretty obvious, the same thing is happening psychologically, that whether it's boredom, loneliness, fatigue, uncertainty, all of these things, these internal triggers, prompt us to look for relief. And we will find relief in whatever way we have habituated to find it. So if the quickest path is by turning on the television so we don't have to think, or making a cup of tea so we can avoid our boredom, whether it's whatever the practice might be that we have habituated ourselves to look for relief from that discomfort, we will take that path unless we decide to change that bad habit into a good habit. And so that's why it's so important. You know, one of the mantras of the book is that time management is pain management. That none of the advice out there, none of the techniques work, including the ones in my book, don't work unless you first and foremost start with step number one, which is to figure out these internal triggers, to master the internal triggers so that you can either deal with the source of the discomfort or learn tactics to cope with it in a healthier manner that leads you towards traction rather than distraction.
Is there anything that you've discovered or learned over the last few months, particularly since COVID, that you wish now you could add to the book? Or has there been a particular way that you've had to adapt your routines and rituals? And I guess another question that goes along with that is, has there been a biggest surprise or a biggest impact that you can tell us about from your work?
Well, I'll share a little secret that I actually don't write for my readers. I don't, and I'm not one of these writers that writes when they have the answer. I write to get the answer. And so this book was written for one person, and that person was me. And it sounds incredibly selfish, but that's the only way I can find the motivation to keep working on a line of research for 5 years, is because I hate reading books that regurgitate research that you've read a million times. God, if I heard about the marshmallow study one more time, I'm going to scream. I don't want to hear the same summary. I could search for that on Google. I wanted to know what really works. And the reason I wrote this book is because I tried all the other techniques. I tried the digital detoxes. I tried putting my phone away. And I did the same thing you did, right? I put the phone away. And you know what? It's a really good time for a cup of coffee. Let me go make one. Or let me read that book that I've been meaning to you know, look at again. Or, you know, let me fold the laundry. I would keep finding excuses to not do what I said I was going to do. And so that really drove me to figure out, okay, what is the answer once and for all? If I know what to do, which, by the way, you know, this is the exact same question that Plato asks 2,500 years ago, 2,500 years before the internet, Plato, the Greek philosopher, asks, he calls it akrasia, the tendency to do things against our better interests. He wonders, why is that? If we know what to do, why don't we just do it? So this is not a new problem. You know, we've been thinking about this for at least the past 2,500 years. And so I kind of wanted to get to the bottom of it. What's the psychology behind why don't we do? If we know the right thing, especially these days, when if you don't know the answer to something, just Google it, right? Like the answer to who doesn't know basically how to lose weight? Who doesn't basically know how to be better at their job? Who doesn't basically know how to have better relationships? All these things require us to have our full attention at no matter what we're doing, to do and follow through with whatever we say we're going to do. So the problem can't be that we don't know what to do. The problem is that we keep getting in our own way. We can't stop getting distracted. And so that's why I really wanted to focus on this and why I call it the skill of the century. Because I think the world is going to become increasingly distracting, you know, between artificial reality and virtual reality and who knows whatever else reality, the world is only going to become a more distracting place. So I think it's critical for us to learn how to become indistractable. And I think you asked me what surprised me since I published the book. I think the response among parents has been really fantastic. I was really, you know, as a father myself of a 11-year-old little girl, we've struggled with this question about how much screen time is too much and what are the effects. And, you know, we want to raise a tech literate daughter so that, you know, we know the jobs of the future are going to require tech literacy. So we don't want to scare her, but we also want to make sure that she develops these skills to moderate her behavior and make sure that she can self-moderate. And I've been really heartened to see how parents are using these techniques. And because I think the knee-jerk reaction as a parent is to blame stuff, right? You know, I talk about in the book about I open this section of the book with the sugar high, right? Don't we all know that sugar makes kids crazy? We all know this, right? Common sense. 100% absolute bunk. Studies have found there is no such thing as a sugar high. The only people that are affected by too much sugar, unless it's a medical condition, of course, but it's not the children that are affected by the sugar, it's the parents. That parents, when they give kids a placebo, but they tell the parents that the child was given sugar, they follow the kid around, they criticize them more, they berate them, they think they're acting crazy when in fact, they haven't even had any sugar. So it's us that's the problem. And yet, you know, despite the fact that we as parents are always looking for a reason why our kids are behaving in a way that we don't like because of something else outside of us, and of course we jump to, it's rock and roll music, it's video games, it's the news, whatever, to see that parents are adopting this strategy to help raise indistractable kids is wonderful. I'm so happy to see it.
That's great. Been looking forward to asking you this question. BJ Fogg recently tweeted that smartphone use might become the new smoking and that being chained to our phones could become a low status behavior. What do you think of that idea? Do you think that there might be a revenge of analog or a post-digital age, or at least in how we relate to these things?
The cigarette isn't the perfect metaphor for a few reasons. One, it's hard to justify why you can't why you need cigarettes, right? Whereas, you know, you could tell some, you know, people who smoke, everyone I've ever met who smoked wishes they never started, right? And they wish they could just get rid of it forever. It's not the same case with our technology. We can't stop checking email. We can't stop using GPS. We can't these devices are critical for our livelihoods for many of us. And why should we? I mean, they're, you know, products getting better and more engaging isn't a problem. It's progress. We want these tools to be engaging. What are we going to start? Hey, Netflix, you know, your shows are far too engaging. Please stop making such interesting programming. Okay. Apple, your phones are far too user-friendly. Can you please make them harder to use? I find that I like to use it a lot. No, come on. It's not going to happen. We're not going to go in reverse. So I think it's not the technology that's the problem. And I think this is the broad stroke that, you know, is very, it has a lot of popular appeal, but I think we're conflating the bad aspects of the technology with many of the good aspects. The good aspects aren't the problem. It's the distraction that's the problem. It's using them when you didn't intend to. So I think using technology in a certain way will certainly become a low status behavior. And I think we already see this. You know, when I used to teach at Stanford, I saw the first year I taught there, this was around 2012, I would see students constantly with their phones, and they would go out to lunch together and they'd be using their phones while they're having lunches. In my classroom, I would see students using their phone in the middle of class. And then, you know, for the several years I taught there, I saw less and less of that. It's amazing that students started to call each other out. You know, they would say, oh, I went on a date with this person and they did nothing but use their phone. That in class, they would put their phones away, you know, not just leave them on their desk, but they would actually put their phones away because society started to adopt what we call social antibodies, that we learn as a society when a particular behavior has negative repercussions. We're not idiots. We're not puppets on a string. We adapt our behaviors and we adopt new technologies to fix the last generation of technology. And in this way, I think cigarettes are a good metaphor because, you know, I remember when I was a kid, I remember in the 1980s, I remember we had ashtrays all over our house. In the middle of our living room, we had ashtrays. Now, my parents didn't smoke at the time. My dad had quit years before. My mom never smoked. And yet we had ashtrays in our house. Why? Because in the early 80s, people would come over to your house and they would assume that they could just smoke a cigarette in your living room. That's what people did back then. Now, today, that sounds crazy, right? Who would light a cigarette in your living room without asking? Nobody would ever do that. We all know that is socially unacceptable behavior. And yet back in the 1980s, everybody did that. And in fact, I remember the day my mom took away the ashtrays and threw them away and said, I've had enough. She actually had a friend come over, took out a cigarette and was about to light it. And my mom said, oh, I'm sorry. We are non-smokers. If you would like to smoke, if you'd be so kind to go outside. This woman was so offended. You're going to ask me to go outside to smoke? Yeah, she did. You know why? Because my mother was this pioneer of sorts, and she had to kind of put her neck on the line because she knew that she was a particular type of person. She was a non-smoker, right? And if you were a smoker, you could go outside. And we are doing the exact same thing today with our technology. And this is why I called the book Indistractable. The title is Indistractable because Indistractable sounds like a superpower. It's meant to sound like indestructible. It's an identity. And so what I want to spark is a movement of people who are as brave as my mother was and said, you know what? I'm going to do a little bit of a different behavior. I'm not going to check my phone every 5 minutes. I'm not going to be chained to constantly responding to what other people want from me. I'm going to decide for myself how I spend my time, how I control my attention, and how I spend my life. I am indistractable. And so if we could do it with cigarettes, 30, 40 years ago, we can absolutely do it today with technology.
Just to clear up a potential misconception that people might have here, one of the things that's become really apparent over the last couple of months and one of our 10 pillars from our mental fitness toolkit is connection with other human beings. But we're talking here about, well, hang on, let's get off social media if we can occasionally, let's send a few less emails. Can you define what connection means to you, how digital technologies get in the way of real connection, and how we can go about making sure that the people in our lives aren't this lovely term that you use, residual beneficiaries of our time right. And attention.
Yeah. Yeah. So the term residual beneficiary. So I learned this term in an economics class, my freshman year. And, it happened to be a class that, where I met my wife, my future wife, who I've still been married to now for 19 years. We met in that freshman college class, and a few years after we graduated from school and we got married, and I remember my wife turned to me one day and she said, "Nir, you have made me into the residual beneficiary." And it hit me like a ton of bricks. And here's what a residual beneficiary is. A residual beneficiary is the chump that gets whatever's left over when a company is liquidated. Okay, so if a company goes out of business, first the debt holders get their share, then the equity holders if there's anything left. And if there's anything still left over, the residual beneficiary gets whatever scraps are left of the company. And so my wife telling me, "You have turned me into the residual beneficiary," because we both knew this term, I knew exactly what she meant. She meant that I was leaving her for last, that, you know, I made sure my work was done. I made sure that I took care of my parents and I took care of my friends and I took care of everything else, my own ambitions. I went to the gym. I did all this other stuff. And I left her whatever scraps of time were left over. And she is the most important person in my life. And so I've changed that practice, that now part of becoming indistractable and part of making sure we maintain these connections to people we think are important in our life is to plan that time, is to schedule it, even when it seems like it's a bit of work. And I think what we're seeing today with this loneliness epidemic that's happening, certainly in America, I know it's happening to some degree in Europe as well, in several OECD countries, is that we find that there's this loneliness epidemic that is occurring because people are losing connections with each other. And this is not something that has happened because of technology at all. Robert Putnam wrote about this problem in his book, Bowling Alone, in the 1990s, right? He was talking about how the problem is caused by this disintegration of civic groups, that Americans in particular, you know, used to go to the bowling league every Thursday, and the church group on Sundays, and the Kiwanis Club on Tuesdays. And these social institutions, these social clubs, these reasons to get together every week at the same time and place, we don't participate in anymore. And this is not something that social media did. Social media became popular because we quit these things. And I'm not somebody who's advocating for people, you know, rejoining church, but we have to replace it with something. That connection that we used to have in a physical time and place is missing in our lives. And so what I advocate for is bringing it back. You know, if you're a secular person, you don't want to go to a religious institution, or bowling is not your thing, that's not what I'm advocating for. I'm advocating for something, having a time on your calendar that is immovable, that is sacred, that is protected. Because this is why we don't have friends and relationships like we need. And we know that loneliness is as detrimental to our health as smoking and obesity. It is an epidemic, and we have to make time on our calendars for people in our life. And this is a situation, you know, we tend to come from the perspective of, oh, social media is bad. No, thank God for social media, because if we didn't have it, we wouldn't have any social connection right now during this quarantine. I mean, can you imagine having to go through Corona without Zoom and Facebook and Instagram to stay in touch with people? Now, it's not enough. It's certainly not enough. It's kind of like a vitamin, right? A vitamin is a supplement. So you can't just take vitamins and expect to be healthy. You supplement vitamins in pill form with nutritious food. And it's the same thing with social media. Social media should be a supplement to in-person relationships. We need those in-person relationships in our life. Hopefully, after we get out from quarantine, we'll be able to actually see each other physically. But this is the next best thing, and I think we should take advantage of that. I mean, one good thing that's come out of the quarantine that many people are under is that for the first time, people are scheduling regular check-ins with their loved ones, right? They're having these Zoom calls. Every Friday, I'm getting together with my family or my friends, and I'm going to see each other, and that holds a place on our schedule. I really think that is, I hope that that is something that we continue to do after this lockdown.
One of the things that I write about in my diary is that connection doesn't seem to have a scoreboard like other areas in our life. There's no one holding up a sign saying this relationship is going well, this one's going poorly. You've actually got a quote that I think you borrowed where you say that friendships die of starvation, but it's very hard to know when that happens, as opposed to things like our bank balance or our career or how many likes we got on Instagram. These things are all very measurable, whereas relationships aren't so measurable. And one of the things that we talk about in our book, and, you know, the values of Indistractable are what we've been talking about for the last 3 or 4 years, have a weekly connection, whether it's a phone call, combine it with a walk, go outside, take your phone, go for a walk and get the best of movement and a connection. Or if you are able to catch up for coffee, do it in person. This is one of our values. I think that one of the key things you said there is turning values into time. And values gets a really bad rap from a lot of people because they think it's someone from church preaching at them about whether they should steal or take drugs or what have you. But that's not what values is at all. Values is just what we decide is important and how we want to choose our time, what we want to think about. And the big idea behind Resilience Agenda is mental fitness. And the big idea behind that is that if you want to improve your health and you want to improve your fitness and you want to improve your mental health and fitness, then you've actually got to prioritize it and put it into Stephen Covey's important but not urgent category or quadrant and time block, schedule it out, whether it's a weekly connection, the time you'll go to bed every day, when you'll meditate of a morning, when you might write in your journal, etc. How would you advise people to go about integrating these rituals of gratitude or mindfulness or writing and sleep into a busy schedule?
Yeah, so it's exactly what you said earlier of turning your values into time. So I have a very specific definition of values. Values are, my values are attributes of the person you want to become. Attributes of the person you want to become. So the central question is, how would the person I want to become spend their time? So, you know, I talk to a lot of people who have this as a stumbling block because I think there's been something happening in the in the self-help community where values became like a really heavy, big deal that, oh, you have to go on a meditation retreat to understand what your values are. You have to create a vision board. You have to ask yourself, what are the regrets of the dying? It's a really big ordeal. And I think that's the wrong thing to do because that leads people to think, oh, it's so much work. I don't have time to even do that. And so instead, what I advocate for is, you know, instead of planning out, you know, your 5-year plan or your regrets of the dying or your vision board, how about we just start with tomorrow? How would the person you want to become spend their time tomorrow? And then what we want to do is we ask ourselves these three life domains. So there are three life domains. It starts with you. You are at the center of these three life domains. If you can't take care of yourself, you can't take care of others. So first you start with the you, right? You are the center of these three life domains. And so you ask yourself, how would the person I want to become spend their time taking care of themselves? And in this case, you can decide whatever it is that's important to you, right? What are the attributes of the person you want to become? How much time would the person you want to become spend on proper rest, exercise, learning, prayer, meditation, video games? Anything that's important to you, anything that you value, anything that any way that the person you would want to become would spend their time, do it. And it's not up to me or anyone else to tell you that you shouldn't spend your time this way or that way. It's not for anybody else to judge. It's only for you to judge what your values are. But no matter what your values are, I want you to turn those values into time. If one of your values, one of the attributes of the person you want to become, is that the person I want to become spends an hour a day playing video games. Awesome. Put it in your calendar and enjoy it without guilt. Because one of the things that people don't realize is that when you live your life by a to-do list, which I advocate against, I am not a fan of to-do lists. When I don't like to-do lists because they have many psychological, many ways that they are detrimental to our well-being. If you live your day through a to-do list rather than a calendar, is that you don't even enjoy your leisure time. Right? When I used to live my life according to a to-do list, I would come home from work and all I want to do is just relax and watch some Netflix or play with my daughter. And even then I felt guilty because there's all these undone to-dos that I didn't do. And so I couldn't even enjoy my leisure time. As opposed to when you use a time box calendar, that hour you want to spend playing video games is exactly what you plan to do. Now it has become traction. Anything else is a distraction. So first you start with that central circle of you. The next life domain is your relationships, which we talked about a little bit earlier, planning the time to be with the important people in your life, either, you know, through a technology or physically there if you can, but planning that time on your schedule. And then finally, the work domain. And this is the last domain. It tends to be where people start, and I think it's actually where people should finish. We have to ask ourselves, what type of work do we do? And everybody does some share in their day of the two types of work. There are two types of work. We have what we call reactive work, and we have reflective work. Reactive work is all the stuff that we, you know, the time we spend reacting to emails, reacting to notifications, reacting to Slack channels. That's how most people spend most of their day, because frankly, it's easier to live that way. It's easier to constantly respond and not have to think about, wait a minute, what should I be doing? So responding to the urgent as opposed to the important. The other type of work, which is higher value, is what we call reflective work. Reflective work is time spent strategizing, planning, thinking. We have to do that without distraction. We cannot do reflective work if we're constantly being distracted. So I'm not advocating that you spend all day with your door closed, not talking to anyone, only doing reflective work. You'd probably get fired from your job if you did that. What I'm advocating for is to plan at least some part of your day when you are doing reflective work. And that depends on what kind of job you do, right? If you're a computer engineer, you probably require your entire day doing reflective work, because the more times you're interrupted, the more mistakes you're going to make, the more bugs are going to be in your software. If you work in a call center, almost your entire day is spent reacting to just picking up the phone whenever it rings. So it really depends on what kind of job you do. But my guess is, I bet that every single person listening to me right now, everyone has some amount of work in their day that requires them to reflect. And so make sure you plan that time and protect it in your day.
Can you talk us through what a typical day or week looks like in your schedule, and, you know, try and be as detailed or specific as you like, I mean, in terms of when you get up, when you allocate self-care activities, where you put your daughter and your wife in your day? And I guess where I'm going with this is, how are you so remarkably productive and prolific? Now, I'm sure you've got a great team around you, but even that requires management. You write books, you consult, you travel the world speaking, or at least used to before COVID. You round things up on your blog, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Tell us about your days and weeks and what those blocks look like.
Yeah. So it's constantly being refined. So I make my calendar on Sunday nights. I have 15 minutes in my calendar to plan my calendar. And those 15 minutes, it only takes me 15 minutes a week to look back at the previous week and ask myself, how can I make the week ahead easier to follow? How can I make that schedule easier? So I'm not putting more tasks on my plate. I'm trying to figure out how I make it more likely that I will do what I say I'm going to do. So it's not about jamming in more productive stuff. It's about figuring out, okay, I fell off track here and here last week. How do I make sure that that doesn't happen again? And that's really the difference between someone who is distractible and someone who is indistractable, is that the distractible person keeps getting distracted by the same thing again and again, right? It's okay if you're distracted by something once. That's okay. Life happens, right? There's things that are outside your control. But if you keep getting distracted by the same thing again and again, well, now that thing has become predictable and you are making the mistake of not doing anything about that problem. So there's a wonderful quote by Paulo Coelho who said, "A mistake repeated more than once is a decision." So if you keep getting distracted by the same thing and you're not doing anything about it, you have decided to be distracted. As opposed to an indistractable person, doesn't mean they never get distracted. It means that when they get distracted, they take steps to make sure it doesn't keep happening again and again. So when I sit down every week, I look at that calendar. I'll give you a link actually for the show notes. I built a tool to make it super easy for anyone to adopt a time box calendar. I'll give you the link for the show notes. That nearandfar.com/schedule-maker. And at that URL, basically I made this very simple tool. It's totally free. You don't have to sign up for anything. I just made a very simple tool because I kept getting asked this question of like, well, how do I get started with this? So I laid it out all there. But I use Google Calendar. You can use Microsoft Outlook, anything that you want. You can use a paper pad. You know, you can use your product, right, where it's on paper. It really depends. It's not about the tool. It's about whether you keep using it, right? The best tool is the one you will use. So whatever it is that you will use to keep a calendar. So what you're going to do is you're going to sit down and you're going to plan the day or the week ahead. I tend to do it once a week. So I have my whole schedule ahead of me. You're gonna ask yourself this question of how can I make the calendar easier to follow in the week ahead? And the attitude that you should take is not a drill sergeant, it's a scientist, right? A scientist runs experiments and asks themselves, okay, I got distracted. Well, there are only three reasons I got distracted. There's only three reasons I fell off track. Either it was an external trigger, an internal trigger, or a planning problem. That's it. There's only three potential reasons. And so once I know what one of those three potential reasons caused my distraction, I can do something about it so that doesn't happen again in the future. And I don't think that there's any like ideal calendar. There's a lot of myths out there that, oh, if you get up at 4 a.m., that's the secret to productivity. And if you take a shower in freezing water, come on, that's silly. There's no science around that stuff. If it works for you, do it. That's wonderful. If you find that that's where you're most productive and it's working for you, terrific. And that's why we have to experiment with all different ways. But let's not be so strict with ourselves to think, oh, you know, I read somewhere that I have to wake up at 4 a.m. That's the only way to be productive. No, if that's not working for you, play around with it. But once you make your plan, you have to stick with it. That's why time boxing is so effective.
Speaking of being productive, I'm sure you've cast your mind to future works after the success and impact of your first two books. I'm sure you've got plenty going on promoting them and all that sort of thing. Can you share with us any ideas that are bubbling away in your mind for a third book or another message that you think the world might need?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, right now I'm so focused on Indistractable. I feel like that's something the world really needs right now, that I'm trying to put my heart and soul into it. I'm creating an online class, and I'm doing as many interviews and podcasts as I possibly can, and writing as much as I can, because I you know, it's not good enough just to have the knowledge. Now that I have it, now that I feel like it's changed my life so profoundly, now it's time for me to share it. Now it's time for me to get the word out, because there is no area of my life that hasn't been impacted by this. I'm in the best physical shape of my life. I used to be clinically obese, and now I've never been in better shape. I'm 42 years old. I've never had a better relationship with my wife or daughter. I've never been more productive at work. And so it really has touched every area, every domain of my life. So that's, for the foreseeable future, all I'm doing is spreading the word about what I've learned in the 5 years of research that it took to write Indistractable.
Great. And how can we learn more about you and your work?
Yeah, thank you so much. So my blog is at nearandfar.com, but near is spelled like my first name. So that's nirandfar.com, nearandfar.com. There's actually an 80-page workbook that we couldn't fit into the final edition of the book, and that's complimentary. So if you go to nearandfar.com, you'll get that 80-page workbook there if that's of interest, and that's a free guide to help you become indistractable. Whether you buy the book or not, doesn't matter. But if you do decide to check out the book, it's titled Indistractable, How to Control Your Attention and Choose Your Life.
And before we finish up, can you give the people who might be going for a walk or, you know, listening to this podcast because they're distracted from something they should be doing, can you give them three tips for something they should do right now? When they click stop on the podcast, what should they go away and do or think to make some of this actually happen, other than buying you a book, of course?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so I think the first step is to ask yourself, what are you getting distracted from? Right. What you can't call something a distraction unless you know what it is distracting you from. So as opposed to complaining about all the stuff you're not doing, ask yourself, what exactly did you plan to do with that time? Not your to-do list. Right. Again, I'm not a fan of to-do lists. I think that they backfire. But instead, what did you plan to do with the time you have? And if you don't have anything, well, that's the problem. So the first step, I think, is understanding the internal triggers, understanding what you are running away from. What are those problems, the emotions? The next step is making time for traction. That's step two. The third step is hacking back the external triggers. And I show you exactly how to do that in the book as well. And then the fourth step that we didn't talk about at all is about preventing distraction with pacts. And this is where we can actually use technology, ironically enough, to hack back technology. And so we make all kinds of pacts with ourselves, with other people, with technology, with ourselves, in a way that as a last resort, as the last line of defense, the firewall for distraction, we make these pacts. And so it's using these four techniques. Number one, master internal triggers. Number two, make time for traction. Number three, hack back external triggers, and number four, prevent distraction with PACT. That's the backbone. That's the model to become indistractable.
Wonderful. Well, thanks so much for your time. Look forward to maybe even having you on again in the future. It's been a lot of fun. I hope you've enjoyed it. I certainly have learned a lot. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Resilience Agenda Radio, the mental fitness podcast with me, Hadley Fisher. If you enjoyed today's episode, we invite you to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform so you'll never miss an update. If you'd like to know more about Resilience Agenda or mental fitness, jump on over to www.resilienceagenda.com. There, you can learn more about our other guests and pick up the show notes from today's episode. You'll learn more about our story, the Mental Fitness Toolkit, and discover our best-selling mental fitness diaries, jam-packed with dozens of strategies and ideas for how you can improve your mental fitness each and every day of the year. Over 25,000 people every year use our diaries to plan time for their own mental fitness or as unique and meaningful gifts for family, friends, and colleagues. That's it for today. We look forward to you joining us next time.